It's our great pleasure this morning to welcome John Fox to speak to us. He tells me that when he was a long time ago in Rome and beginning to train for the priesthood, sermons were abolished and homilies were brought in. So I put homily rather than sermon, though I'm not sure there's really a difference. Perhaps it's length. John and Glenn, whom we're delighted to see as well this morning, are friends of this congregation and have been for a long time. John, you're not the first Roman Catholic preacher that we've had this year. I'm sorry. we had one of the chaplains from the university at the end of January, Father Dushan. But that doesn't mean you're not welcome. You're perhaps just a bit less of a curiosity to all these Protestants than you might otherwise have been. But we know you well, and of course, you are the historian of this place and this congregation. And that is a little unusual, I think, in the Reformed tradition, that it should be a Roman Catholic who has revealed to us our past. And that's a wonderful thing, because sometimes those of us who are in the tradition think we know our past. I'm going to stop talking, otherwise I'll lose my voice. And it's wonderful to have somebody who can show it to us from that wider perspective. So we welcome you very much and invite you to come now and speak to us.
Thank you for that lovely welcome. If I can just put that down there. Thank you for the invitation. That little book on the chapel that I was asked by Charles Brock to write years and years ago, I think it's the proudest piece of history that I've ever done. And I did start off with misgivings, and I thought, Sunday school, you know, how do I turn that into a film? And as I dug deeper, the one thing that really stood out about this congregation, and it's had its feuds, it's had its politics, its battles, some of them, big veil of silence over them, but you know they're there. What is really stands out is the number of bridges built, the reconciliation, a bit like the tail end of the parable we've just heard. And that parable, beautiful. Why do we call it the parable of the prodigal son? We really should call it the prodigal of the really good dad, but we don't, because in the sort of Daily Express style, we seize on the prodigal son because bad news is always far more interesting. And that's what we've done with it. And I wondered about the text for today, and after hearing, I had all sorts of things, but after hearing Colin, I think the text really should be, my mind is full of all sorts of things that shouldn't be there. I mean, that really. And if you're talking, and I said to Colin, I'd like to talk on prayer. And if you're talking on prayer, that's a wonderful description. It's when your mind is full of all sorts of things. But whether they shouldn't be there or should is another matter. It's Mothering Sunday. A salute to all our mothers, and to the mothers in the congregation. And I said something really daft the other day to Glenn. I said, I couldn't be a mother. And I thought, it's the sort of thing you say in Lancashire. And there was a reason. There was this lady with two babies, two children, and they were in two separate buggies, not the big Panzer pram that you get now, but they were in two separate buggies. There was a wind. She was trying to cross a small bridge in Stratford, and one pram went that way, the other pram went that way. It looked a nightmare, and she looked fraught. Behind her is an elderly couple. They stepped in. And the elderly lady, who was obviously a mother herself, immediately took over one pram, calmed the mother down and said, wouldn't it be better if the two of us pushed the pram separately? And the mother said, yes. And the children looked at the strange lady. And then they crossed the bridge chatting. And by the end of the bridge, those two mothers, I'm sure, were friends. I still couldn't be a mum. They taught us to walk. They taught us to eat. Not to leave anything on the plate and to sit at table until we had finished everything, unpalatable though it was. They taught us to look after ourselves. They taught us to survive, breathe properly, wipe your nose. And they also taught us to pray. Mine did. Very devout Irish Catholic. The first prayer was a bit of a lost cause. Every night and every morning, your prayers, dear baby Jesus, make John a good boy. And I think somewhere about the age of 9 or 10, she gave up. I was a lost cause. But the other one, I still do. And I find it one of life's enormous props. And that is to go past a church, not to go past, to pop into a church, which she always taught you, but don't pass a church without going in. You go in, and on the corner of the altar, there is a red sanctuary lamp. It's alive. I'm not talking magic now or being sentimental, but it's alive. It says the sacrament is there, it's reserved. And you go on one knee at the back, where the tax collector goes, not at the front. And you do feel that sometimes. You go on one knee and you say, hell's teeth, Lord, where am I? And you actually share. There are no formulas. Sometimes you can't find the words. Sometimes your heart's full. Sometimes you're really cheerful first thing in the morning. And sometimes you just don't know what to say, which is what prayer is about. One of the frightening things about... Oh, one other little thing. Mothering Sunday. Just let me say this. If this was a medieval chapel, here's a bit of history. There would be a doom here, a great doom painting. And on one side would be the wicked, including usually a bishop and a king. And they'd be going down to hell, and hell had big teeth, giant jaws. And you'd sit and look at that throughout the service. On this side, not exactly an inspiration for small boys, would be everybody trooping up to heaven in compulsory nightshirts. And actually, for a small boy, it's not really an interesting place to be thinking you're going to. On the way out, and especially after the priest has thundered, you're all going that way, in many medieval churches, they'd have a lovely painting of the Virgin Mary. And the Virgin Mary, she's not quite winking, but there is a scale of justice, the doom scale. And she's looking at you. And you're feeling so depressed because you know you're going downhill. And she's got her rosary beads. And she's putting them to cheat, like a shopkeeper might put a little lead weight in. She's putting them to cheat to make sure your side of the scale tips down and you don't go to hell. You go that way. And that's the comfort of a mother. Don't worry, everything's all right. And the arms go around you. And it was part of religion. And Colin's really fascinating thing about God showing the traits of the good father and the good mother. Which brings me to Wallace and Gromit. And Wallace and Gromit have a branch in France. I knew you'd like this. We went to stay in a tiny village that had a bakery and that chuckled every morning when we walked in and I tried my French and I'd do the shopping and they'd correct me immediately. And the other great point of interest in the village, it had a tiny factory 100 years old. John, you must come, you'll love this, but they didn't tell me what the factory was. We went in, they turned the electrics on, and the electrics powered a machine that can only be described as Wallace and Gromit. It had been converted from crank to electricity, they're very proud of that. One of the few left in France. And they displayed it for us. And I can't do the noises, but you know all the steam coming out and the wheels going round, people running around with spanners. You know the cartoon. It was a rosary bead factory. And there aren't many of them. And this rosary bead factory was punching out plastic rosary beads, wooden rosary beads, that weren't metal ones, posh rosary beads, cheap rosary beads. The crisis in the rosary bead world, olive wood increasingly hard to get because of the feud between Israel and the Palestinians. So what do? You buy it from Sicily, which is nearer, cheaper, but you still put on the back of the little cross at the end of the rosary beads, Holy Land, olive tree. Okay, so you can maintain the prices. Fascinating basic economics. These are, I don't know the word for them, but these are what the rosary beads were punched out of. Honestly, I'm not having you on. They're what the rosary beads were punched out of, and the yellow wood is, I'm told, olive from Sicily. And it brings me on to a rosary bead. Because one of the features when we were children was two pairs of rosary beads. Rosary beads are like worry beads. When you pray, you fidget. When you talk to people, people fidget. People throw their hair back. When you pray, you feel that itch between your shoulder blades that you can't quite reach. But you need to do something. Your body is part of your prayer. It's also a bit of an interruption. And yet it's part of you, so it can't be an interruption. The rosary beads, like the worry beads in the East, which I think they came from, they're part of keeping your fingers occupied. How many people don't know how to stand? Put the hands in the pockets. Hands like Napoleon. How many people don't know what to do with their feet when they're standing? How many people don't know what to do with their eyes when they're looking at you? It's our body, you know, this thing we carry around. It's so useful. At the same time, it seems to get in the way. The rosary beads we had at home, they were for when you were sick. You can't think straight. You're feeling miserable. There's something to touch. Like occasionally a driver would stroke a St. Christopher medal. I'd never sneer at that. I'd never laugh at that. Because the stroking, reminding yourself of something or other bigger than you, that's a prayer. The rosary bead, fumbling the rosary bead. And I can remember my father's hysteria more than once, near hysteria when he lost his rosary beads because he carried them in the trenches. And there was something that when you're very, very busy fighting or shooting or doing the most awful things in the world, you put your hand in your pocket to feel it. That's a prayer, because you don't have time or the mentality to formulate prayers in words. So the rosary bead factory, Wallace and Gromit, and yet taking you to something which has a very real place, like the rocks, like this formation. There are things I notice around this lovely, I would call it a Calvinist chapel because of its whiteness. And yet there are stimulus, tiny bits of green in the stained glass. The rocks here, which I think is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Prayer. You talk about prayer, people get uncomfortable because they think it is rabbiting at God. You come back from a conversation with somebody, you meet somebody in the village. I come out every morning for the paper, or nearly every morning, and people let on. They say hello, which is great. Sometimes you stop and talk. Sometimes you meet somebody who is a very good listener. You come away and say, we had a great talk. Well, you actually did the talking, but they listened and they made it possible to have a great talk. And prayer is about listening. When you go down on one knee in a visit to church for 2 minutes, prayer is about listening rather than the words and a gesture. Spirituality, a great word, we use it, there's a place for it. At the same time, it leaves the body out. And yet your body prays when you pray, and it's part of your prayer. And the other thing that I used to find youngsters, ever we talked about religion, the thing that, there are two here, I'm ruined. Pointed windows. And youngsters identify pointed windows with God, and it spooks them. It does, it spooks them, because of our Gothic heritage and the things that we've done. Talk about the desert to youngsters, and talk about going into the desert and listening to the silence, which has been the root of the Muslim and the Jewish and the Christian religion. We're all desert religions, desert cultures. And you talk about listening to the desert, suddenly it rings a bell. Then you go into little distractions about the desert culture. And then you meet a 25-year-old who comes up to you and says, I've been. Who are you? What are you on about? I've been in the desert. I've actually heard that silence that we used to talk about in class. But you've not used the word prayer because it's got many, many overtones. Timing. There's no length for prayer. It can be 2 minutes. You used to go to papal high masses, or we were drafted into papal high masses in the old days, when they lasted a good 2.5 hours. Not easy. And one of the noble families of Italy, a member would always be there present at a papal high mass in full hose and doublet, and they would taste the wine before the service. Because in the time of the Borgia popes, there was always a danger of poison in the wine. Now, this was halfway through the 2.5 hours. And this is a confession. You'd have the most awful, awful, un-Christian thoughts. Because the great moment would come, and he would step forward, and he would taste from a little cruet the wine. And you just hoped. Because it would cheer things up and make the time pass a little bit more. And again, I'm being serious. I'm not being facetious. That's part of the prayer. Like the nuns you often hear, and you go and complain about your parish priests, and we had a very, very good bunch of nuns straight out of Call the Midwife. And they'd say, as well as giving you a strong coffee, they'd say, offer it up. Offer it up, the bread, the wine, the offertory, which is a prayer. The number of times you would hear from people, offer it up, make it, turn it into a prayer. I talked about beautiful Calvinist chapel, and I love it after a world of the Baroque and statues. It is refreshing, it's cleansing. But within churches as well, there were movements towards this. Tame, where you go shopping on a Tuesday in the market. At the other end of Tame is Tame Park. We never see the old abbey there, but Tame Park was a leading Cistercian abbey. The Cistercians, basically, were Benedictines who got fed up with too many statues, and they said, let's go back to totally plain stone. And within the old church in Europe, there were movements towards the sort of plain Calvinist chapel. Every so often, people need to change the stimulus. The stimulus itself, we used to have the signs of the cross. When it light, the thunder and lightning, it can become a superstition. You have to be careful. Thunder and lightning, the first lightning, you were taught as children, you crossed yourself. It's a prayer. It's not protecting you. It's not saying if you stand out with your feet in a wet bucket that you won't get hit. It can become that. But when you've made that sign, it's actually a prayer saying, I know you're bigger than thunder and lightning. It's actually a prayer in itself. The red lamp in the church I've mentioned, the candles. I know many people who light a candle, whatever their faith. If they go into a church and there's a candelabra and a set of candles, they'll light a candle because they can't find the words, but it's a prayer. It actually says something. Flowers, stained glass. Can I go back to conversation? When we talk about prayer, if we can talk about relating to somebody, we leave space for other people, a good conversationalist. I wonder how many people during this morning service, Colin, you'll understand this, I wonder how many people their eyes have glazed over and they've been miles away. Colin at the beginning said his mind was full of things elsewhere. I wonder how many of you, while I've been talking, you've wandered out of the church, back home, or back into childhood. That is part of the way we are made. We have minds like budgies in cages trying to get out. Make it part of the prayer, don't fight it, and see where it leads you. You touch. Somebody yesterday in a conversation, they were laughing. They put a hand out. It's a dramatic thing, as if to steady yourself in your laughter. They put a hand out and touch my arm. You touch when you have conversations. When somebody's bereaved, and rather than cross the road to avoid them, you go to them, and you can't think of the words to say, but you touch an arm, you reach out. Similarly, in prayer, people bow at the end of a prayer. I must say, and I'm being very, very open now, I must say, if I've gone down on one knee, stopped in at Blackfriars on St Giles just for a couple of minutes, I'll sometimes, and I know it sounds daft, but I'll put a thumb up and say, okay, see you, and out, out. All right, you don't put that in the formal Church of England prayer book or the Roman Missal, but that's part of what it is. People, the vicar of Wheatley conducted a funeral. He and I laughed about it, and a lot of people have. And it was a lovely funeral. He closed the curtains of the crematorium, pressed the button, the curtains went round. The family rushed the podium. You haven't finished. And he looked quite shocked. He'd never been in that situation. They had a poem to read. They all wanted to touch the coffin. They all wanted to touch. He pressed the button, and the curtains went back again. And there was laughter throughout the end of the cremation. And he said it was so human. They hadn't finished. They wanted to touch. Again, part of our conversation. And Humour, the man at Edge Hill up in Warwickshire, the general in the Civil War. And it's a prayer that's often quoted. Lord, I'm going to be pretty busy today. This is the morning of the battle. And if I don't think of you, well, please, you think of me. Can I close by just making three little points? Try praying for the people you dislike the most, or for those you've hurt badly. Our old Pope John, who everybody loved in the 1960s, John the 23rd said, prayer doesn't change anything. It actually changes people, and they go out and change. And if you pray for somebody you can't stand, or whom you've hurt, a whole range of people like, it actually changes your attitude to them inside. It does something to your heart, does something to your head. Second thing, think of prayer as a framing. When you get a picture, it's got tatty edges. You're not quite sure if it's been finished or did he just wind the canvas around the stretcher. If you think of it as a frame to put round the bit of your life that you're praying about or concerned about or happy about or thankful about, think of it as a frame that makes a picture. And the third thing is, let me quote an East German politician who may have prayed, I can't guarantee it, but he said, years after the Berlin Wall fell, he was the prefect in Berlin, East Berlin, who gave the order for the gates to be opened. And he said something lovely in old age. He said, I've made a lot of mistakes and done some stupid things in my life, but that order was the one that I am most proud of. Mm-hmm. And they held him to task in East Germany. He was proud of it. A frame, a perspective, and a prayer for those you least instinctively led to pray for. Thank you for your patience, and share each other's thoughts on what prayer is. You'd be surprised how rich there is a seam to be tapped.